The first principle of coincidence is to bring it in early to gain time to build meaning out of it. The inciting incident of Jaws occurs by coincidence. A shark feeding itself randomly happens to eat a swimmer. But once in the story, the shark doesn't leave. He stays and gathers meaning as he continuously menaces the innocent until we get the feeling that he's doing it on purpose and, what's more, enjoying it. Coincidence, therefore, must not pop into a story, turn a scene, and then pop out. As a rule of thumb, do not use coincidence beyond the midpoint of the telling. Rather, put the story more and more into the hands of the characters. And never, never use coincidence to get an ending. This is Deus Ex Machina, the writer's greatest sin. Deus Ex Machina is a Latin phrase taken from the classical theaters of Greece and Rome, meaning God from the machine. From 500 BC to 500 AD, theater flourished throughout the Mediterranean. Over those centuries, hundreds of playwrights wrote for these stages, but only seven have been remembered, the rest mercifully forgotten, due primarily to their propensity to use Deus Ex Machina to get out of story problems. Storytelling was as difficult 2,500 years ago as it is now. But ancient playwrights had a way out. They could cook up a story, twist turning points until they had the audience on the edge of their marble seats. Then, if the playwright's creativity dried up and he was lost for a true climax, convention allowed him to dodge the problem by cranking a god to the stage and letting Apollo or Athena settle everything. Who lives, who dies, who marries, who is damned for eternity. And they did this over and over. In essence, nothing has changed for 2,500 years. Writers today still cook up stories they can't end. But instead of dropping a god in to get an ending, they use acts of God. The hurricane that solves the lover's problem in Hurricane. The elephant stampede that resolves Elephant Walk. The traffic accident that ends The Postman Always Rings Twice. Deus Ex Machina not only erases all meaning and emotion, it's an insult to the audience. Each of us knows we must choose an act, for better or worse, to determine the meaning of our lives. No one and nothing coincidental will come along to take that responsibility from us, regardless of the injustices and chaos around us. We could be locked in a cell for the rest of our life for a crime we did not commit. But every morning, we still have to get up in that hell and make meaning. Do I bludgeon my brains against this wall, or do I find some way to get through my days with value? Our lives are ultimately in our own hands. This is why Deus Ex Machina is such a terrible sin. It's a lie. Comedy writers often feel that in their wild world, the principles that guide the dramatist don't apply. But whether coolly satiric or madly farcical, comedy is simply another form of storytelling. There are, however, important exceptions that begin with a deep division between the comic and tragic visions of life. The dramatist is fascinated by the inner life, the passions and sins, madness and dreams of the human heart, but not the comedy writer. He fixes on the social life, the idiocy, arrogance, and brutality in society. The comedy writer singles out a particular institution that he or she feels has become encrusted with hypocrisy and folly, then goes on the attack. When a society cannot ridicule and criticize its institutions, it cannot laugh. The shortest book ever written would be The History of German Humor, a culture that suffers a paralyzing fear of the establishment and authority. Comedy is, at heart, an angry, antisocial art. To solve the problem of weak comedy, therefore, the writer first asks, "What am I angry about?" He finds that aspect of society that heats the blood and goes on an assault. All characters pursue desire against the forces of antagonism, but the dramatic character is flexible enough to step back from the risk and realize, this could get me killed. Not the comic character. The comic character is marked by a blind obsession. The first step to solving the problem of a character who should be funny but isn't is to find his or her mania. Almost any obsession will do. In All in the Family, Archie Bunker was a blindly obsessed bigot. So long as he doesn't see it, he's a buffoon and we laugh at him. But if he were to turn to someone and say, "You know, I'm a rotten, racist hate-monger," the comedy is over. Comedy tolerates more coincidence than drama, and may even allow a deus ex machina ending if two things are done. One, the audience is made to feel that the comic protagonist has suffered enormously. Two, he never despairs, never loses hope. Under these conditions, the audience may think, give it to him. At the climax of the gold rush, the little chap is nearly frozen to death when a blizzard rips his cabin off the ground, blows it and Chaplin across Alaska, then drops him smack onto a gold mine. Cut two, he's rich, dressed to the nines, smoking a cigar, heading back to the States. The incisive difference between comedy and drama is this. Both turn scenes with surprise and insight. But in comedy, when the gap cracks open, the surprise explodes the great belly laughs of the night. If you pitch your story and people don't laugh, you've not written a comedy. You've written something else. But it isn't comedy. They didn't laugh. The solution, however, is not found in trying to devise clever lines or pies in the face. Gags come naturally when the comic structure calls for them. Instead, concentrate on turning points. For the reaction to each action, ask, "What's the opposite of that?" Then take it a step further to, "What's off the wall from that?" Spring gaps of comic surprise. Write a funny story. The conceit of adaptation is that the hard work of story can be avoided by optioning a literary work and simply shifting it into a screenplay. This is almost never the case. To grasp the difficulties of adaptation, we look again at story complexity. The 20th century has given us three media for telling story: prose, the novel, novella, short story; the theater, legit, musical, opera, mime, ballet; the screen, film and television. The unique strength and wonder of the novel is the dramatization of inner conflict. This is what prose does best, far better than play or novel, because it can directly invade the inner life and dramatize its conflicts at great length with density and poetic power. The unique command and grace of the theater is the dramatization of personal conflict. This is what the theater does best, far better than the novel or film, because personal conflicts are worked out, for better or worse, through talk. And in the theater, dialogue can be lifted to its most beautiful, subtle, complex, and expressive. The unique power and splendor of the cinema is the dramatization of extra-personal conflict. Huge, vivid images of human beings wrapped inside their society and environment, striving with life. This is what film does best, better than play or novel. If we were to take a single frame from The Blade Runner and ask the world's finest prose stylist to create the verbal equivalent of that composition, he or she would fill page after page with words and never capture its essence. And that is only one of thousands of complex images flowing through the experience of an audience. Nonetheless, the screenwriter cannot dramatize personal conflict to the poetic fullness of the theater, and while the inner life can be expressed impressively in film, it cannot reach the density or complexity of a novel. If you must adapt, look for stories in which conflict is distributed on all three levels with an emphasis at the extra personal. First, read the work over and over without taking notes until you feel infused with its spirit. Do not make choices or plan moves until you've rubbed shoulders with its society, read their faces, smelled their cologne. That done, reduce each event to a one- or two-sentence statement of what happens and no more. No psychology, no sociology. For example, He walks into the house expecting a confrontation with his wife, but discovers a note telling him she's left him for another man. Period. That done, read through the events and ask yourself, is this story well told? Then brace yourself, for 9 times out of 10, you'll discover it's not. Or you'll discover it's beautifully told, a clockwork of perfection, but 400 pages long, 3 times as much material as you can use for a film, and if a single cog is taken out, the clock stops telling time. In either case, your task will not be one of adaptation, but reinvention. To reinvent, no matter in what order the novel's events are told, reorder them in time from first to last, as if they were the biographies of an original screenplay. From these, create a step outline using, where valuable, designs from the novel or play, but feeling free to cut scenes and, if necessary, create new ones. Seek a design that expresses the spirit of the original, yet within the rhythms of a film, ignoring the risk that critics may say, but the film's not like the novel. To learn adaptation, study the work of Ruth Prower Jabala. Like a chameleon or trance medium, she inhabits the colors and spirit of other writers. Read Quartet, Room with a View, The Bostonians. Pull a step outline from each novel, then scene by scene compare your work to Jabala. You'll discover a lot. Notice that she and director James Ivory restrict themselves to the social novelists, Jean Rhys, E.M. Forrester, Henry James, knowing that the primary conflicts will be extra-personal and camera-attractive. No Proust, no Joyce, no Kafka. Playwright and novelist have always understood that their challenge is to do on stage or page what film does best. We compliment Flaubert's cinematic style long before there was cinema. Eisenstein said he learned to cut film by reading Charles Dickens. Shakespeare's stunning fluidity through time and space suggests an imagination hungry for a camera. Great storytellers have always known that show, don't tell, is the ultimate creative task. To write in a purely dramatic and visual way, to show a natural world of natural human behavior, to express the complexity of life without telling. By the same token, screenwriters have realized that their challenge is to do on screen what the playwright and novelist do best, to use images of character in their physical and social world to express and delineate personal and internal conflicts. Stories with holes lose credibility. The story lacks logic, a missing link in the chain of cause and effect. But like coincidence, holes are part of life. Things often happen for reasons that can't be explained. So if you're writing about life, a hole or two may find its way into your telling. The problem is how to handle it. We could forge a link between illogical events and close the hole. This remedy, however, often requires the creation of a new scene that has no purpose other than making what's around it logical, causing an awkwardness as annoying as the hole. In which case, ask, will they notice? We know it's a jump in logic because the story sits still on our desk with its hole glaring up at us. But on screen, the story flows in time. As the hole arrives, the audience may not have sufficient information at that point to realize that what just happened isn't logical. Or the audience may be looking ahead, wondering what's going to happen next, and it passes unnoticed. Chinatown. Ida Sessions impersonates Evelyn Mulray and hires J.J. Gittes to investigate Hollis Mulray for adultery. After Gittes discovers what appears to be an affair, the real wife shows up with her lawyer and a lawsuit. Gittes realizes that someone is out to get Mulray, but before he can help the man, Mulray is murdered. Early in Act Two, Gittes gets a phone call from Ida Sessions telling him that she had no idea that things would lead to murder and wants him to know she's innocent. In this call, she also gives Gittes a vital clue to the motivation for the killing. Her words, however, are so cryptic, he's only more confused. Later, however, he pieces her clue to other evidence he unearths and thinks he knows who did it and why. Early in Act 3, he finds Ida Sessions dead and in her wallet discovers a Screen Actors Guild card. In other words, Ida Sessions was an actress and couldn't possibly have known what she said over the telephone. Her clue is a crucial detail of a citywide corruption run by millionaire businessmen and high government officials, something they would never have told the actress they hired to impersonate the victim's wife. But when she tells Gittes, we have no idea who Ida Sessions is and what she could or could not know. When she's found dead an hour and a half later in the film, we don't see the whole because by then we've forgotten what she said. So maybe the audience won't notice. But maybe it will. Then what? Cowardly writers try to kick some sand over such holes and hope the audience doesn't notice. Other writers face this problem manfully. They lie. They expose the hole to the audience, then deny that it is a hole. Casablanca. Ferrari is the ultimate capitalist and crook who never does anything except for money. Yet at one point, Ferrari helps Victor Laszlo find the precious letters of transit and wants nothing in return. That's out of character. Illogical. Knowing this, the writers gave Ferrari this line. Why I'm doing this, I don't know, because it can't possibly profit me. Rather than hiding the hole, the writers admitted it with a bold lie that Ferrari might be impulsively generous. The audience knows we often do things for reasons we can't explain. Complimented, the audience nods, thinking, even Ferrari doesn't get it. Fine, on with the film.